The title of today's talk, which is based on Acts chapter 7, if you want to start turning to it, you can, is "Please be careful, I have a stiff neck." Some of you might already know where I'm going with this, but if not, then hopefully it will all become clear. So if we want to turn to Acts 7, we're going to come to the Bible passage in a minute. A couple of weeks ago, one of our members here, Rory, gave an excellent preach on the life of Paul and his conversion, really, his dramatic conversion on the road to Damascus and what had happened then. And the encounter transformed his life, as Rory put it, from a mass murderer to a pillar of the early church. There's a dramatic transformation in that. And he encouraged us that if God could choose and use Saul, then he could choose and use us. Now, part of my talk today is actually it's going back. So it's a bit like, it struck me as, who remembers The Phantom Menace when that came out in Star Wars? That it was a case of, you know where he ends up, but now we're going to go back a bit and see what led up to that point. So I'm not going to dwell a lot on Saul. But he was introduced without any sugarcoating at all. He's there, warts and all. This is what he was really like. They're not trying to kind of whitewash what he did. He's introduced at the end of the chapter as a calculating future leader of the established religion, determined to wipe out this Jesus sect, as they saw it, no matter what the cost. We want to look at the victim of this story a bit, Stephen. That's the person I want to concentrate. And I want to look at the challenge and the rebuke that he gave to people that were accusing him. So I'm not going to read all of Stephen's sermon because it is quite long. I think when Dave gave it to me, he said, there's a lot there. There's a whole lot there. But, if you've got the chance, I would recommend have a read through it because it's a great example. It's like an arcing narrative of the whole of the Old Testament. It just sort of reaches right over and just almost like, like big, broad brushstrokes of what God was doing throughout the Old Testament. And as I was reading the sermon, as I was reading through it, I thought, that's amazing how articulate and how well he presented it, despite the pressure that he was under, that he was actually being accused. And, my hope is that I can preach as clearly as he did under these circumstances. But to be honest, I'm kind of hoping for a better outcome. There's plenty of rocks out there, and I haven't got any body armour at all. So, if it all goes well, if I get out of here without having anything at me, then I feel I've won. First I want to give some background to it. Back in the chapter before, Acts 6, it says about how the members of the synagogue have been trying to argue with Stephen. They've been trying to sort of beat him in a theological debate, being trying to sort of like, what was all this? But it said that the Holy Spirit had given him like a supernatural wisdom, that he was able to answer all of their questions, and he was able to, rebut all of their statements that he was saying, and actually that the greatest religious debaters just couldn't beat him. Actually, he thinks when I'm trying to argue something with my wife Catherine, I've just got no chance. Whatever I say, she just comes in. I wish I'd thought of that. Let's have a look at what... We're going to talk a lot about the Sanhedrin. Let's have a look to see what the Sanhedrin looked like. Here's like an artist's impression of the Sanhedrin. Now, I don't know if you can see that. Basically, you've got like a semicircle of people sitting. Then the coloured in black person in the middle is the accused. So you're surrounded by people on all sides virtually. And that's where Stephen would have stood. And then in front of them, there's a couple of clerks that were writing down what was being said. And there was space down at the front, if you like, for students that wanted to learn what was happening and future Sanhedrin members to see what was going on. But it was a closed group. It wasn't open to the public. It was part of the temple, and you had to be invited to be there. The Sanhedrin was made up of up to 71 men. Not all there all the time, but for something as big as this, there was probably going to be all 71 there. And it was set up in the time of Moses. It was a way for them to judge religious issues and religious questions and kind of be a religious authority. And there was a Sanhedrin in every city in Israel. Each city in Israel had one. And then Jerusalem had the Grand Sanhedrin, which made the big decisions. If there was any sort of questions as to what was right in, as far as religion, what sort of laws should be passed, it would come through the Grand Sanhedrin. And they were allowed to operate, even in Roman occupation, that the Romans allowed them to operate on sort of quite a low level without... that they couldn't, for instance, execute people, in theory. Think back on, they were part of the trial of Jesus. Jesus stood before the Sanhedrin, and they passed judgment on him, but they couldn't allow him to be executed. That had to be from the Roman people. That's why he went to Pilate. So it's... they haven't really got a good track record at the moment, as coming off the back of the Easter story. So when he was brought, Stephen's enemies persuaded false witnesses to say that he had been blaspheming and saying that Jesus would destroy the temple and change the customs of Moses. Now, Moses was a very important person to the Sanhedrin. He was really important for Jewish people as a whole, but that was... what everything they did was based on the law of Moses, and so he was important to them. Now, the thing is that what they were accusing him of wasn't a million miles away from the truth. What I want to do is let's look at the things that Stephen had been saying and how they were used to accuse him. Now, the first thing was he was saying, apologies if you can't see it, I'll read it out, that Jesus was greater than Moses. We believe that. That's something that we believe, that yes, he is. But actually the Sanhedrin saw that as blasphemous words against Moses because he held in such high regard. The next thing he was saying was that Jesus was greater than the temple, which they saw as blasphemous words against the temple, against his holy place. The next thing he was quoted as saying was that Jesus was the fulfillment of the law. Again, it's something that we go, yeah, that's right, we agree with that. Yet to them, that was blasphemous against the holy law. That was, you know, that was again something that he was then criticized for. And then fourthly, that he was greater than, yeah, Jesus was greater than their religious traditions and their customs. And they use that to say that Jesus of Nazareth was going to destroy the temple and destroy their customs. He was going to turn everything over. That's what he was being accused of. Now, as an interesting aside, have you ever wondered how Luke found out that all this... it was Luke who wrote Acts, by the way. How Luke found out that all this was said and what happened. How he knew that what happened secretly in the trial and secretly before it as well. Now, in my mind, I think, well, it's most likely that Saul probably told Luke and told, after he'd become Paul, after he'd been made that kind of dramatic transformation, that he probably told them what had happened and Luke wrote it down. But then it struck me that if he had done that, how painful that admission would have been. How painful would have that conversation have been? He's now talking to these people that he shares this common bond with and telling them how he quotes Moses and how he describes their ancestors' behaviour towards him. We're going to start from verse 35 if you're following in the Bibles. This is Stephen talking. This Moses whom they rejected, saying, "Who made you ruler and judge? This man God sent as both ruler and redeemer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush. This man led them out, performing wonders and signs in Egypt and at the Red Sea, and in the wilderness for 40 years. "This is the Moses who said to the Israelites, 'God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brothers.' This is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him at Mount Sinai and with our fathers. He received living oracles to give to us. Our fathers refused to obey him, but thrust him aside, and in their hearts they turned to Egypt, saying to Aaron, 'Make for us gods who will go before us.' As for this Moses who led us out from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And they made a calf in those days and offered a sacrifice to the idol and were rejoicing at the works of their hands. He makes the point that their combined forefathers, their joint forefathers, actually turned away from Moses. And he also says that Moses had predicted that someone would come after them. Now, the Jews had believed that he was talking about Joshua. But I think Stephen's making that point that actually it wasn't Joshua, it was the same root name, but it was actually Jesus who was actually talking about that this greater prophet was going to come. When Moses received the Ten Commandments from God, it was a covenant or an agreement with the people. And the agreement was, if you follow my laws and follow me and my laws, I will be your people and I will look after you. But by turning away from God and from the laws, they actually forfeited the right to be God's people. That's what had happened. That's what had happened in the wilderness. So what's stopping you from being one of God's people? What's stopping you from being known as one of his? Is there something to you that's more important than God? Perhaps it's your job or your friends. Maybe it's your reputation or what you perceive that you would have to give up. Maybe it's your past. The good news is that Jesus provided a way. He provided a way to come back to God, no matter what you did. I say, as Rory said about a couple of weeks ago, it doesn't matter if you're the worst of sinners. Jesus provided a way to come back to him. And if there's anything stopping you from coming to him, I can honestly say that there is nothing in life that even comes close to living as a child of God. As it was said this morning, that there is this incredible joy that comes with it, this incredible joy that comes with knowing that you are a child of God. And you are, thank you. There's even more joy than that, but there we go. It is an amazing situation. I mean, I've been fortunate enough that I grew up in a church. My parents were Christians, and they, minus 9 months I was attending church. And actually, it's always been there as this rock, something in my life that I always knew to be true, and nothing has changed that. But actually, that's what gives me my joy. That's what gives me my security, is knowing that I'm a child of God. And nothing can take that away. Stephen goes on to talk about the temple. And he answers his accusers on his comments about the temple. To do this, he emphasises some things in Jewish history that they may not have considered. And that's that God never confined himself to a single place like the temple. So if you just go down a bit further, we'll look at from verse 47. And he says this, he says, "But it was Solomon who built a house for him," meaning God. "However, the Most High does not live in houses made by human hands. As the prophet says, 'Heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool.' What kind of house would you build for me, says the Lord? Or where will my resting place be? Has not my hand made all these things?" Here Stephen quotes from Isaiah 66 to reinforce the point that God isn't limited to anything man-made. God is so much bigger than anything that we can create for him. Every time we try to box God into something, he bursts out of it. Every time we try and pigeonhole God, he defies that and goes, he's bigger than that. I mean, if you get to on YouTube, there's a video called Indescribable. which talks about the vastness of God, and in the light of creation and in light of the size of the universe, just how amazing God is. And one of the quotes on it, I'm going off topic a bit, but bear with me. One of the quotes on it was, you just look at the vastness of the universe. You look how big it is and how unfathomably large it is. We can't even see with the most powerful telescopes how big that is. And then this person, like Guy Luigiglio, who I really like, he quotes from the Bible saying that the heavens declare the glory of the Lord. And he says, in his mind, this vastness of this universe just starts to come close to giving God the glory that he deserves. This immenseness just starts to edge towards being sufficient to give God the glory that he deserves. I'll come back onto my topic again. Have a look at that if you can. So a lot of people struggle to understand the God of the Bible because of this, because we can't pigeonhole him. There's parts of the Bible that people really thought, well, how can a God of love be like this? And how can a God that is just allow this to happen? And all these things. And it doesn't fit into our understanding. And I'd say thank goodness. Thank goodness that I believe in a God that isn't confined to my intellect. Thank goodness I believe in a God that is bigger than that. I mean, I'm doing some theology training at the moment, and we're delving into the Bible, trying to sort of get to grips with what the Bible says about God. But there's times in there with these very clever people, cleverer than me, that they just say, but then God does this, and we don't really understand that. That doesn't really fit. And if people try and explain it, but ultimately, sometimes things just fall short because we're limited in this human frame. I mean, I think of it like we can't understand God any more than a painting can understand the artist. That the painting is a reflection of the artist, but it doesn't understand everything about the artist. And that's how I think that we are, that we are God's painting. And yet, we're trying to understand the person that made us. But we can fall into the same trap and think that God is confined to a nice building built on the side of a school in Shepparton, and that he sits in here Monday through Saturday going, they'll be here soon. They'll be here. I'll get to see them soon. You can easily fall into that trap. But God is everywhere. God isn't confined. God, wherever you go, God is there. And you can treat that fact in two ways. That can actually make you scared. It can make you fearful. Or it can spur you on. It can spur you on to live a life that pleases him. That wherever you are, God is there. He's there with you. He's there, not with his finger pointing, but there saying, come on, I'm with you. I'm with you in this. We can do this. And he delights when we please him. Waiting at the bus stop down the road. He delights when we please him when we're sitting in school. He delights when we please him when we're at work. He delights when we please him wherever we are, because he is there with us. The third point I wanted to look at was rejection. You see, Stephen later on says that since Moses, the Jewish people had a habit of rejecting those that God sends to them. But then, as if that wasn't enough, he goes on to say that the Sanhedrin were worse than those that killed God's messengers, because they actually killed the Messiah himself. If you look at verse 52, he says, was there ever a prophet that your ancestors did not persecute? Harsh. They even killed those who predicted the coming of the righteous one, those that predicted Jesus' coming. And now you have betrayed and murdered him. This echoes one of the parables that Jesus told in Matthew 21. And I'll just read through it quickly. You don't have to turn to it. He said, listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a wine press, and built in it a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers who moved to another place. When the harvest time approached, he sent his servants to the tenants to collect his fruit. The tenants seized his servants. They beat one, killed another, and stoned a third. Stoned, interesting. Then he sent other servants to them, more than the first time, and the tenants treated them the same way. Last of all, he sent his son to them. "They will respect my son," he said. But when the tenants saw the son, they said to each other, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and we will take his inheritance." So they took him, threw him out of the vineyard, and killed him. Therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to these tenants? "He will bring those wretches to a wretched end," they replied, "and he will rent the vineyard to other tenants who will give him a share of the crop at harvest time." So this prophetic parable that Jesus told actually came to pass on a cross on top of Calvary. Lastly, I'd like to focus on the accusation that seems to be levelled at the Sanhedrin in verse 51. He says, "You stiff-necked people, your hearts and ears are still uncircumcised. You are just like your ancestors. You always resist the Holy Spirit." The insulting part of this is that they were stiff-necked. Why is this so offensive? After all, the whole time I've been preparing this, I've had a stiff neck. It's something that we deal with. Sometimes you have a stiff neck. Why is it such an offensive thing? Now, the term originates from an oxen that was hard to control. It was called stiff-necked, or said to have a neck of iron. Now, I have a little illustration here. You see, hopefully this is still here, pick me up. You see, when I think of this, it makes me think of a TV character called Mrs. Tishell. Now, Mrs. Tishell, for those that don't know, is in a programme called Doc Martin. And she spent probably a couple of series with a neck brace on, like the one I'm wearing. And she would spend the whole time walking around trying to do her job at the pharmacy. And everything was restricted because she had this neck brace on. I think the underlying thing was that she didn't really need to have the neck brace on, but she wore it anyway. She liked the attention that it gave her. But anyone who's had to wear show of hands, who's had to wear one of these for real? A few of you. So, you know, when you're wearing it, you can't really do very much. And if for some reason the TV monitor down there isn't working and you've got to do all your talk using the big screen, I think that's God having a joke that he's just like, "Yeah, I'm going to make it really hard for you." You're restricted. You can't move. And actually, the term stiff-necked is used throughout the Old Testament. Interestingly enough, mainly around the time of Moses. It was a reason that the Israelites, that was given for the Israelites not being able to enter into the promised land. He said that they were a stiff-necked people. And I think for the sake of the recording, I'm going to take this off. And for the sake of my sanity as well. So the Old Testament, God talks to the people that you are a stiff-necked people. So you're not going to enter into the promised land. They're not going to receive the promises that God had given them. Which is, in effect, what the members of the Sanhedrin were doing. Because of their stiff-necked behaviour, they were going to miss out on this promise of God. This promise that there was going to be a Messiah. This promise that there was going to be a person that was going to make things right. Allow them to enter into God's promises. And yet, due to their stiff-necked behaviour, they were going to miss out on that. So how about us? Are we stiff-necked? Does it matter if we are? I used to think that I was happy to embrace new ways of thinking. That was until my children started going to school and came home with homework. They don't do maths the same way as we used to. This is really upsetting. So, maths was truth. This is long multiplication. This sum up here on the screen is long multiplication. That is how you do it, in my mind. Yet, my children came home with that. I know. How can that be long multiplication? Now, you know, say for the sake of the recording, we've got the sum on the left-hand side showing how you get 237 times 24. And then on the right, believe it or not, is how you get 35 times 26. And apparently you split it all up into a grid and you add all the bits of the grid together and it does come out with the right answer. But I could not get my head around that because it says maths was truth. You know, it was black and white. It wasn't like English literature where you kind of put your own slant on it. You know, there wasn't necessarily a right answer. Although probably those doing GCSEs this year probably think there is a right answer. But, you know, if I was to be of any help to my children, I had to understand that the way that I thought things should be done isn't necessarily the only way, that there could be another way of thinking. And I had to be willing to accept that. Otherwise, I wasn't going to be any good. Not that much good anyway, but, you know, especially now they're getting a bit older. But Steve Petch, who leads the Coin Church over in Woking, one that we're quite closely linked to, he recently said, and I thought this is really interesting from him, if you've got someone with all sorts of flaws but is teachable, then we can do anything. They could even be incompetent to some extent, as long as they are open and listening when you bring a challenge. But if you've got someone, even if they're relatively senior and mature, that thinks that they've arrived, that thinks that they've got it, you can do nothing, can't do anything with them. So what are you learning right now? I'm going to ask for a show of hands, just to pre-warn you. Because whenever someone's at the front saying, put your hands up if, you know, has this happened to you? Put your hands up. Oh, I wasn't really listening to what I was maybe putting my hands up for. So give you a pre-warning. I'm going to ask for a show of hands. Hands up if you feel that you've arrived and that there's nothing more in your character that really needs work on. Show of hands. Okay. Hands up if you can think of something immediately that God would want to change about your character. That's good. That was my worry. I was thinking, is it just me? Yeah, hand up as well. Yeah, for that. So if we all recognise that we are a work in progress, let's not pretend that we are anything but that. We are all an unfinished masterpiece, and each day adds another brushstroke. I'll say that again. We are all an unfinished masterpiece, and each day adds another brushstroke. So that's not to say that we're not worthy, you know, we're an awful person. Actually, you are a masterpiece, but you're a masterpiece that's in progress. Now, we all have things that God is nudging about. Apparently, we all have things that God is nudging about. Perhaps it's our short temper. Perhaps it's a temptation that we all keep giving into. Perhaps we are treating someone in the church that we have disagreed with in an unkind way. All these things need dealing with. And to deny it is only stopping us from experiencing the purposes that God has for us. Let us not be a church that explains away each other's failings. Let's be accountable to each other and work on being the best that we can. Dave, on the Vision Sunday, spoke about how we want people to feel like they belong. Then eventually to believe in what Christ has done for them, and then to become more like Christ. Let's not skip over that last bit. Let's not only half finish it. You know, yes, those first two bits are important. We want people to belong to something. We want them to feel part of community. We want the people to believe in what Jesus did. But let's not just stop short of all of us in that last section becoming what we could ultimately become. See, sometimes we have a tendency, I think, to excuse things. We say, oh, don't mind Keith. He's a bit shouty, he's a bit angry. I'd say no. Let's not have that as something that we just excuse and just say that's just the way they are. We are God's church. We are his bride being made ready for the ultimate wedding in heaven. let's make ourselves the best that we can be. You know, God didn't make Keith, sorry if there's a Keith here, I apologise, didn't make Keith an angry person. He made him to be a child of God. He made him to be the bride, part of the bride. So let's not just settle with that's what that person's like. Let's press on and press on and keep pressing on until we've got no breath in us left to press on with. Now, please don't think that I've got all this worked out, because I haven't. The reason I called this Be Careful I Have a Stiff Neck is that I know that I have trouble being turned. I too easily start to think that I've got it all together, that I've got it sussed. It is in my nature as much as I'm sure it is in yours as well. But in summary, I'd like to ask and answer a few questions. Why should we turn our necks towards what God is calling us to do? Why should we stop alienating someone over the way they acted? Why should we embrace the person that hurt us? The reason is because of God's lavish and limitless grace. Last week we rejoiced in the fact that our dear friend Eric was welcomed into God's arms as a good and faithful servant. One day, God will do that to the person that you struggle to get along with, just as he will do it one day for you. His grace and his love are the motivation for us to turn our neck. We love because he first loved us. If you have never turned towards God and looked at him, if you've never turned to recognise who he was, today is the day to do that. And if you know that you are resisting God turning your neck in some way, resisting God turning your neck to mould your character, today is the day to change as well. I'm going to finish with the song, Words of a Song, by Alan Jackson. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. As we break the bread and drink the wine today, let's do it together as a body moving towards becoming more like Christ, knowing that we're not there yet. Thank you.